You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 6, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, justice writer at Vox, Ian Millhiser, on his new book, The Agenda. Also on the program today, the Biden administration commits to waive vaccine patents for the rest of the world. Meanwhile, pharma's stocks plunge in its wake. Huh. Federal judge vacates the CDC national eviction moratorium. Liz Cheney about to be booted from Republican leadership. Okay. Adams edges Yang in the latest New York City mayoral poll. Mitch McConnell says he's 100% focused on obstructing Joe Biden's agenda. Bipartisanship, whither, where art thou? I don't know what that was. Columbia police fire into protests, at least 24 deaths, over 80 missing. The Labor Department makes it easier for workers to sue over misclassification by rolling back a Trump-era rule. Speaking of which, gig companies spend at least $1 million in lobbying Congress to reject the PRO Act. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for being here on this Thursday. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland is here. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello. I am well.
You look like you're about to start laughing.
Well, I don't know. I feel sometimes like it's Groundhog Day because you ask me how I am every morning. But you
I'm
know,
checking. It's a polite thing to do.
It is polite, but we hang out or slash are working together about 2 hours before the show starts.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe it changes. I just checking in on you.
I always say this when the show starts. I always perk up, get a little rush, and have even more fun. So
yeah,
show improves my mood, which is shocking.
Just want to see if you're better than you were before, which apparently you are. So that's great. Glad to hear it. We got to come up with another.
You really don't. I don't know why I'm having some sort of fixation. It's like a manifestation of my low grade anxiety.
All right. Well, there you go. So there we finally gotten the answer.
That's a very specific answer, actually.
Exactly. Well, how are you? You've got low grade anxiety.
Well, it usually comes out at night before I'm supposed to go to bed. So I'm good. I'm good at this
Starting
point.
Starting you off early today. Yeah, the sooner you start, the quicker you can recover.
Yeah, I guess. So,
folks, a lot to talk about today. Joe Biden sort of dancing around, trying to deal with the fractures that are appearing within the Democratic coalition or the Democratic caucus, frankly, regarding taxation, regarding expenditures. Joe Manchin apparently not taking Mitch McConnell seriously when Mitch McConnell says 100% committed to obstruction, because there's no evidence that Mitch McConnell would ever commit to such a project. We have no experience whatsoever with the idea that Mitch McConnell would be 100% committed to obstruction and has no interest in bipartisanship. Therefore, Joe Manchin being skeptical about what Mitch McConnell says, that makes total sense in some other alternate universe, which makes no sense whatsoever. Meanwhile, on the this is a twofer. actually sort of a threefer for us. We always like to check in with Fox and Friends. Right. And the reason is because they're a good way to take a temperature as to what the talking points are going to be for the day with the Republican Party. But they do so in a fun and light way that it makes it much more fun to enjoy.
Fun, that term is being used quite loosely.
It's loose. I mean, although I, you know, like yesterday we talked about Brian Kilmeade attacking a 13-year-old sixth grader who was talking, maybe 12-year-old sixth grader who was talking about...
Who pwned him.
Yeah, who said the most obvious thing in the world, that the new president is doing a better job in dealing with COVID than the old president. That is, by anyone who is... at least in sixth grade, not a controversial statement.
Kilmeade's brain has not developed past that point.
So. He has regressed. But meanwhile, this was on Fox and Friends today. It was notable for a couple of reasons. One, it is an incredibly restrictive and disenfranchising law signed into law by DeSantis in Florida, Ron DeSantis. Two, it was part of Ron DeSantis's run for president in 2024. Mark my words on this.
Be afraid of that, by the way.
And be concerned.
He could be actually someone that makes some noise.
Three, it was one of the most egregious examples, unabashed examples of propaganda that one could imagine. This isn't just Fox News is covering the signing of this bill. DeSantis had excluded all local media from covering the signing of this bill so that Fox could have an exclusive. And it wasn't just we're covering this. We're actually building it into a segment. And so...
no local outlets. Even though this is a Florida bill. He's not the president of the United States, which would still be ridiculous going on national TV. This is a... should be for... like, local media should have access to
it. Yeah, you can't trust that local fake news. You got to go to the multinational corporation owned by the Australian reactionary.
And let's be clear... the argument here is that we're doing this despite the fact that you're going to hear DeSantis say, like, or the, I don't know if Fox and Friends has an official job in the DeSantis administration, if they still refer to themselves as Fox guests in this hosts in this segment. But they say, like, your 2020 election went off fine, but now we need to pull back from providing so much access during COVID. Well, why? We know why.
Because Democrats voted by mail than Republicans in Florida.
And so DeSantis wants to show off his Trump bona fides by holding up his poster. So let's go to this clip. It really is stunning.
After the pandemic, Governor, a lot of people loosened up the rules because a lot of people didn't want to come out of the house. There were drop boxes, no excuse, mail-in balloting and things to that nature. After years of struggling on Election Day and maybe extending it too long, most famously, in 2000, you guys pretty much pulled it off flawlessly last time around, and you were able to get the results in. Now it's time for people to rein in and have a non-pandemic election. In over 30 states, they've made reforms. You're doing the same thing. What's going to be different about Florida's election in 2022? What are you about to sign?
So right now I have what we think is the strongest election integrity measures in the country. I'm actually going to sign it right here. It's going to take effect. So
there you go.
Bill is signed. And here's what it does. If you look, here's what it does. Now, we've always had voter ID. We're making sure we're in.
Do you hear what, keep that image up there? Because this is a little bit off point. Emma, we'll tell you in a second, like, you know, exactly what this does. But you hear Ducey say, you came with graphics. And then he holds up a Florida leads on election integrity and transparency. The transparency is hilarious because literally they have shut out all of their local media from covering this.
Yeah, I know. We overuse the word Orwellian, but...
Jesus. Exactly. But, I mean...
aka Zuckerbucks?
Maybe I'm being a little conspiratorial here, but those colors on that graphic that Steve Doocy was like, oh, you came with your own graphics, are exactly the color palette. And every network uses a specific color palette. They have like a style guide when they do graphics. Those are exactly the Fox News graphics. I mean you can see how integrated it looks
with
the rest.
You are just like, you've lost your mind. I mean, that is just like red, white, and blue. It looks like Bernie's font.
It might. I would be curious. I mean, since
they're sending a message to the radical communists.
Well, I just wonder if who did up that graphic? I mean, it is a Fox News exclusive. And it would be interesting if I was a reporter in Florida and I was a little annoyed. That would be my FOIA right there. Mm-hmm. It would be my FOIA. But tell folks exactly what he's signing there that he's so proud of.
So, right. I mean, the issue here is that, okay, as Fox just explained, nothing went wrong in Florida, but yet they have to overcorrect for something.
Got to rein it in.
Yeah, they've got to rein in something that they literally lead into the segment saying went fairly perfectly, I guess, you know, during the presidential election the last time around. So what this does is the initial bill was supposed to ban drop boxes altogether. So the silver lining is that there still will be drop boxes in Florida, but there's tighter rules about where they can be. So they have to be at the official voting place, essentially, and there are limits on the hours where some drop boxes are able to be accessed, which will most likely prevent people who can't get out of work from voting from getting to the drop boxes. The boxes need to be staffed by an employee who's overseeing it, and when the box isn't staffed by an employee during official hours, there's going to be round-the-clock video surveillance of the drop boxes. It also just prevents what Republicans call ballot harvesting, which is this made-up term, essentially, or they've manipulated the term to sound a lot more evil,
nefarious,
and evil than it is. They've limited, and the details, and I've read multiple articles, it hasn't laid it out quite yet about how they limit it, but it limits basically who is able to drop off someone else's ballot. So say it's an elderly person or a person who's poor, who doesn't have a car, who needs someone else to drop off their ballot for them. There are limitations on that, and now voters have to provide their driver's license, state ID number, or last four digits of their social security number when requesting a mail ballot, which is the same thing that you need to register to vote. And the other thing it does too, which I think is actually low-key a lot more destructive than, I don't know, the other parts that have been emphasized, is that it spreads out the votes on mail-in ballots, essentially. So oftentimes when you get a mail-in ballot, you'll have multiple elections on that ballot. They're dividing it up so that essentially you have to request multiple mail-in ballots, and that's just the start of it.
They're just all of these things are just roadblocks to what they say rein in. What are they reining in? They're reining in the number of people who are going to participate in the next election.
And I just want to add, it also took notes from the Georgia bill, which they banned the handing out of water within some sort of slash food within areas of the ballot site. So it's all just an effort to make it more difficult. And it doesn't matter what those provisions are, essentially. I mean, yes, it does. But the fact that there's many of them just shows that they're trying to make it harder for specific people.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent at Vox, author of The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. We'll be right back after this. Today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Counseling, and they're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. What is BetterHelp? It is it gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist. You can access, you can get this access via phone. You can do it through a chat or video. A lot of therapists have long wait lists. Sometimes it can take weeks and months before they can see you. When you sign up with BetterHelp, They match you with a therapist based on your specific needs. You'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. I have to say that during COVID, obviously, and I have been seeing the same therapist for several years, we switched to teletherapy. I don't know what else you call it. You know, we have FaceTime type of, they have a, you know, mechanism. And I like it. And I don't know if I'm going to go back into the office when it's okay to do so.
Well, it's more convenient.
For the most part, it's, you know, it's just as effective, if not more, in some respects. And it's certainly like much, much more convenient.
Yeah.
But that is, you know, I have to say that has been one of those things that we're going to come out of the pandemic and I think is going to change. And the beauty of BetterHelp, however, is that once it connects you with a therapist, unlike the way that you traditionally find a therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason at no additional charge. There's nothing worse than finally going to see a therapist, deciding after a couple of sessions that it's no good, and then it's taking you another couple, several months to get back into therapy with a different one. That's one of the biggest pluses of BetterHelp. They have thousands of licensed therapists. They're from all over the country. They have therapists with specialties that may not be available in your area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/MajorityReport. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/MajorityReport. BetterHelp.com/MajorityReport. You can find the URL in our video description if you're watching on this on YouTube, or in our podcast description if you're getting it as a podcast. Okay, I want to welcome to the program senior correspondent at Vox, author of The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. Ian, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Good to be here. Thanks so much.
Congratulations on the book. It is, in many respects, I think, you know, you and I have spoken over the years, and so much of this stuff, you have educated this audience about things that have been coming down the pike, and we've sort of crossed that toll, and we're now, to belabor a metaphor, we have done the on-ramp and we're on the pike now. It is no longer coming down the pike. We are there. And the idea, the premise of your book is that Republicans no longer, in part because they can't maybe, but they no longer have to rely on legislating to fundamentally change Americans' relationship with government and with society in some respects. So just lay that down for us, and then we'll get into the specifics. You have really four, silos in which our society is really going to dramatically change. But just give us the overall premise.
Sure. So, I mean, I started writing this book at the end of kind of a lost decade in Congress. So from 2011, when Republicans took the House and basically denied President Obama a governing majority, until 2020, when the pandemic hit and, you know, non-action became untenable, Congress basically did nothing. I mean, there's the Trump tax bill, but like there was hardly any major legislation enacted for a decade. And in the same period, the Supreme Court dismantled campaign finance law. It hobbled the Voting Rights Act. It weakened the ban on sexual harassment. It held that religious liberty claims can be used to overcome employees' rights. It halted President Obama's Clean Power Plan, his most ambitious effort to fight climate change. It weakened unions. And then, you know, lest you think it was all bad news, there was also the marriage equality decision in there. But like the point is that the Supreme Court became the locus of policymaking in the United States. Congress was unable to do anything. The president has fairly limited powers, and the Supreme Court is now working to limit the president's powers even more. And so the one unelected branch of government, and the branch where Republicans now have a two-thirds supermajority, has become the primary policymaking body in the United States. And, you know, regardless of whether you like what they're doing or not, I think that's pretty scary because, you know, we should want to be governed by the sort of people that we can throw out of office and not by unelected judges who serve for life.
And there's a certain irony there because ostensibly a lot of these members of the Supreme Court would ostensibly agree with you. But many of the things that you outline here, particularly in chapter two, is making it impossible in some ways for there to be, for that to happen, where a government, someone who's been elected to office, the president and their administration, is really unable to execute a lot of policy because of the polarization we have in the country and the sort of the structural changes that are going to be that the Supreme Court's going to be involved in. And so let me just ask you that one more general question. The 6-3 court represents a danger, it seems to me, that is sort of fundamentally different, broadly speaking, than what we've had in the recent memory, because they are going to be tackling sort of some structural things that function like proxies. They're not going to necessarily decide on one narrow instance at the EPA, but they could end up promoting a doctrine or changing things in such a way that they're going to defang all agencies, and they're going to deny people the franchise to vote in some respects, and they're going to deny people access to the courts, and they're going to allow religion to trump some other sort of societal principles, all which seem to me to be very structural in what they're going to tackle.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the general thesis of the book is that the Supreme Court is making a two-pronged attack on democracy. And the first prong is that they're just going after voting rights. You know, they're legitimizing partisan gerrymanders. They're dismantling the Voting Rights Act. You know, the reason why you're seeing these voter suppression laws out of Georgia and Florida and probably Texas and Arizona very soon is because the lawmakers in those states know they can get away with it. And they can get away with it because the Supreme Court is telling them that they can get away with it. And at the same time that the court is dismantling voting rights so that it's harder and harder for the Democratic Party to compete fairly in elections, they are also dismantling the government's ability to function so that if someone like Joe Biden manages to slip through the cracks, despite all the efforts that are being made to prevent Democrats from voting, then he will be a very weak president. And so let me give you an example of how this works. There's two ways that Congress can regulate. One is they can just pass a law saying you must do this thing. So like if they want power plants to have less pollution, they could say you must install this device that reduces emissions. The problem with that approach is that technology changes, and if Congress had passed that kind of law in 1974, there would now be obsolete technology in all these power plants, and like the law actually might do more harm than good. So what Congress did instead is they passed the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act says that power plants have to use the best available technology. That's the words of the statute, the best available technology to reduce emissions. And it is up to the EPA to determine what the best available technology is at any given moment. So they can constantly update its regulations to say, oh, there's this new thing, so now you have to use this. And the idea is it's still democratic. Congress still sets the policy that the best available technology should be used, but it's also dynamic. Congress doesn't have to go in and pass a new law every time that someone invents a new thing. And the Supreme Court is now trying to dismantle, and there are at least 5 votes for it, Congress's ability to delegate power to agencies in this way, or at least the Supreme Court wants to give itself a veto power over everything that is done to regulate by an agency. And that's, again, really troubling. You know, like I said, what we're seeing is a two-pronged attack on democracy. On the one hand, they want to make it very, very hard for certain people to cast a ballot. And on the other hand, they want to make it so that if someone like Joe Biden slips through, then Joe Biden isn't actually able to govern because the Supreme Court can veto anything that he tries to do.
I want to spend a little more time on this because the delegation principle. What is it? The non-delegation
doctrine is what conservatives call this veto power they want to give to the Supreme Court.
Will you just expand a little bit on the EPA is a great example, but give people a sense of the scope of what this implicate and when we've seen this in the past.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's all kinds of laws that delegate power to agencies in this sort of way. You know, like the Labor Department has the power to decide who gets paid overtime regulations. You know, the Department of Health and Human Services has all kinds of powers to determine what sort of insurance we get and like how doctors can't discriminate and how hospitals have to be run and what you have to do if you want Medicare and so on and so forth. And I mean, all of this could potentially fall. I mean, let me give you an example of what I think is going to be the first major. I mean, this lawsuit has already been filed. It's making its way up through the courts now. There's a provision of the Affordable Care Act, which says that health insurers have to cover certain preventive care. And then various agencies within the Department of Health and Human Services has the power to add items to this list of required coverage. And it's a long list. It's about 80 items. It's everything from like vision care for children to pap smears to birth control, various forms of cancer screening. You know, there's a lot of like very routine health procedures on this list. And there's a lawsuit right now that I think is going to prevail, which argues that it is illegal for Congress to give these agencies, you know, to give these bodies within the federal government the power to add items to this list. And once that's struck down, that means no more free birth control. That means no more free cancer screenings. That means no more free pediatric care. It means no more free a lot of things that we are all getting from our insurance company right now. So everyone's insurance is about to get a lot worse because of the Supreme Court.
And I just want to make sure that everybody understands that this is the reason why you want, in this instance, again, HHS to do that is like they're getting data coming in and saying, you know what? If folks have a regular colonoscopy or they have a regular, new screening for this type of cancer, we can save X number of lives. And we've just found that out. And we know that Congress is never going to pass anything like that. Like, right. Like, this is what I think is really important for people to understand here. The Republicans could not vote down the ACA. They tried. They couldn't do it. That is, in our very messy system, an expression of the will of the people, right? I mean, it's a little blurry, but that is about as good as it gets for us. And this is the court coming in. They did it with Medicaid by basically saying that the states can, and they're doing it now with what the patient protection part of the ACA is, which is, we're not going to allow you to call it insurance unless it provides these essential care things. And now they're assaulting that. And so this is all, when they do this stuff, it is a proxy for a whole other set of things that actually impact people on a daily basis.
Right. And it's important to understand why it's necessary for Congress to delegate power in this way. So it's not just that, like, the HHS might get new data showing that colonoscopies are good. It's that, for example, perhaps a novel coronavirus might emerge that Congress couldn't possibly have known about in 2010 because it didn't exist when the ACA was passed. And, you know, right now we're in a period where, like, the government is buying up a bunch of vaccines and everyone can get one for free. But that's probably not going to be, like, once we've got this thing under control, that's probably not going to be the permanent state of how we control COVID-19. Like, the permanent state is we're probably going to need, you know, annual or at least frequent booster shots. And at some point, it's not going to make sense for the government to go and buy up a bunch of shots and give them to everyone. It's going to make sense to integrate that into the normal health system. So you go to your doctor, your insurance company pays for the booster shot, and, you know, the doctor gives you the booster shot as you need them. And the law which allows HHS to say to insurance companies that they have to cover that COVID booster shot is this provision of the ACA that is now being challenged. So, like, we're not just talking about, you know, a situation where, like, okay, now it's a little harder to legislate, but, like, Congress can just pass new laws. We're talking about whether or not we can have a government that's able to respond to new problems. Because, again, you know, it's ridiculous to think that in 2010, Congress should have known, like, oh, there's going to be this pandemic in a decade. And so we need to pass a law that requires insurance companies to provide treatments for this disease that does not yet exist.
So can you just give us a sense of the scale of this? Because we're not just talking about the Supreme Court here, right? Like, we're talking about, I mean, I'm trying to find the figure here, 234 federal judges appointed by Donald Trump, three on the Supreme Court, 54 on the Court of Appeals. So, like, a lot of focus, rightly, is on the Supreme Court and the effect that that has, the chilling effect that that has on public policy, obviously. But they have multiple fail-safes. It's like if the Titanic was actually effective, how they had multiple layers to prevent against some sort of sinkage issue. So, I mean, that's a terrible analogy, but, you know, that's how I visualized it in my mind for a second. Can you just talk about that? Because I think, like, they've really made sure that their agenda is going to be protected on multiple layers.
Yeah. So what we've already seen in the lower courts is a lot of what's called forum shopping, where, like, there's a Republican party or like there's a Republican litigant, often it's the Texas Attorney General, that wants to get a Democratic policy struck down. And so what they will do is, like, just to talk about the geography of the courts for a second, the country is divided up into various districts. I think there's like 86 judicial districts, and then those districts are divided up into divisions. And in many of those divisions, there's only one judge. And so if you file your lawsuit in the right division, you can guarantee that you will get your lawsuit in front of this one judge. And so a very common practice by Republicans, if they want to strike down a law, is they will file in a division where there is one extremely conservative judge, and that judge will basically just rubber stamp whatever, you know, the Republican policy is. We also see a lot of cases being brought in the Fifth Circuit, which is Mississippi, Texas, and Alabama is part of the Mississippi, Texas, and Louisiana is the Fifth Circuit. And the reason for that is because the Fifth Circuit is the Trumpiest court in the country right now. You know, Trump put a lot of people on, super conservative. And so what will happen is, for example, Biden tried to put in place a 100-day moratorium on deportations, you know, so he could figure out what was going on with our immigration policy before he started deporting people. Almost immediately, a Trump-appointed judge struck that policy down. And, you know, someone form shopped to get in front of that Trump-appointed judge. The judge's reasoning was ridiculous, but the case would appeal to the Fifth Circuit, and then it would go to the Republican-controlled Supreme Court. So after this Trump judge struck down the moratorium, Biden just decided to drop it, because what was the point? It was only a 100-day moratorium. You'd go to the Fifth Circuit. They'd probably lose in the Fifth Circuit because it's such a Trumpy court. Maybe you could win in the Supreme Court, but by the time you got up to the Supreme Court, the case would probably be moot anyway, because the 100 days would be over. So you have two interlocking problems here. You have a Supreme Court that is extraordinarily conservative. And then you have all of these Trumpy judges on the lower courts who feel emboldened because they know that, you know, they're probably not going to be reversed. And even if they are reversed, who cares? They could issue an injunction and it might be in place for 2 years before a court gets around to removing it. And Democrats just don't have the same luxury to go after a Republican president. I mean, Democrats tried to forum shop in order to get their cases challenging Trump policies in front of friendly judges. And the Republican Supreme Court would just, you know, snap their fingers and dissolve those decisions.
Okay, so and we should say the moratorium didn't prevail. Last month was the lowest number of deportations that we've had in, I believe, in decades. It was under 3,000 for the first time in ages. But nevertheless, so let's get back. I want to get we skipped chapter one, which is the voting things. And to be honest, I think, like, you know, we've had other opportunities to talk about the assault on the Voting Rights Act and what that opens up the opportunity for everything that we're seeing now. So and we're already at chapter two. So let's just, I want to touch, because these things are more obscure. And I think, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about the writing that you do, Ian, is it helps communicate to people just how important this is. We haven't had any major legislation in 10 years. I don't know that we will have anything structural, you know, under the Biden administration. Knock on wood, we hopefully can. But if we don't, you know, if the Senate's gone in 2022, forget about it. It's not even going to be close. But these things are going to resonate. Let's go, when we talk about the administrative state, let's go to the Chevron doctrine too, which is the other sort of like, I guess, rubric, if you will, that is important in terms of the administrative state, the government being able to function in a way to help people. What is the Chevron doctrine and where is the threat to it?
Sure. So the Chevron doctrine is a doctrine of deference. It means, it says that. So there are various laws, like I said, that give agencies the power to regulate. Sometimes those laws are ambiguous. Sometimes it's unclear exactly which power has been delegated to an agency. The Chevron doctrine says when it's unclear, the court should defer to the agency's interpretation of the statute. And it's part of a broader philosophy that really emerged, you know, during the Roosevelt administration, that when things are unclear, we generally want the elected branches to make the decision. If you go back to, you know, the early Roosevelt years and before Roosevelt, the Supreme Court would often make up doctrines looking at the vaguest parts of the Constitution and then would use them to strike down minimum wage laws, to strike down child labor laws. And, you know, what they would do is they would point to some ambiguous phrase of some extraordinarily ambiguous phrase of the Constitution, like the word liberty. And say, like, oh, well, we think that there is a liberty to enter into contracts where you're paid less than the minimum wage. And it was basically just the justice making things up. And so these deference doctrines emerged as a nod to democracy, as a way to say, look, like, there's all kinds of legal questions that don't have clear answers. And when the answer is uncertain, as a general rule, we want democracy to prevail. And this was the dominant way of thinking amongst not just Democrats, but amongst Republicans. I mean, you know, Reagan talked about the need for judicial restraint. You know, Nixon railed against judges who imposed their social views from the bench. So, like, it used to be that there was a widespread agreement that we want the Democratic branches to be the ones that govern. What I think has happened is that, you know, Republicans have lost the popular vote in 7 of the last 8 presidential races. They'd have I saw one study that showed that the only reason they wouldn't have controlled the Senate since the late 90s if senators were chosen in free and fair elections rather than through the malapportion process that we have now. And so you have a political movement, you have a political party that depends on minority rule. It doesn't have any confidence in its ability to win free and fair elections. And I think, you know, once you lick the lollipop of minority rule, you suck it forever. Like, you know, once you accept the premise that it's okay for Donald Trump to become president with 3 million less votes than Hillary Clinton. You know, once you accept the premise that you can confirm three Supreme Court justices, even though you're, you know, you don't have a block of senators represent a majority of the people, once you accept that, I just don't think it's very hard to make the leap to say, well, we've got these six oligarchs with lifetime appointments. Why don't we let them rule?
Right. And so, OK, in the Chevron doctrine basically would have give us a sort of a real world example of something that might implicate our daily lives. Once they overturn the Chevron doctrine, or, you know, overturn maybe it's too strong, once they just basically mutate it, change it. Give us an example of how that might impact us.
So, I mean, the Chevron doctrine deals with ambiguous statutes that allow for regulation. But I actually think what the Supreme Court is doing is much bigger than going after Chevron. So, the big scary thing that I think they're doing in this space is something we referred to earlier called the non-delegation doctrine, which claims that it is unconstitutional for Congress to permit agencies to regulate in certain ways. And like the way that the court has described this, like the dominant approach within the court right now was articulated in an opinion by Neil Gorsuch. He said that the Constitution provides that state. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong quote. He said that a federal law permitting agencies to regulate must be sufficiently definite and precise to enable Congress, the courts, and the public to ascertain whether Congress's guidance has been followed. Now, I don't know what that means, and I don't think that Gorsuch really knows what it means either. It's just this vague, made-up standard. And the thing about vague standards is that when the court announces a vague rule, it's giving power to itself. Like, if there's a law saying the speed limit is 65, then you know how fast you have to drive. And if you get hauled into court and you're driving 64, you can say, look, I was driving less than the number. You can't do anything to me. But if the law says that everyone must drive at a reasonable speed, then who's going to decide what a reasonable speed is? Well, the courts are going to decide what a reasonable speed is. And whether or not you get hit with a speeding ticket is going to be entirely up to the whim of some judge. And so that's what Gorsuch is doing here. That's what the Supreme Court is doing here. They're saying, yeah, like regulations can sometimes happen, but they have to fit within this vague standard and no one knows what it means. And we get to decide what it means. And so if we see a regulation we don't like, we can just get rid of it.
Yeah, just so much of the judicial philosophy seems to be working backwards from creating one's own power, right? And it creates like this or reaffirming one's own power. And I'm just curious if you think because justices are unelected that there isn't more public scrutiny on the fact that they're immense hypocrites in the way that they approach every case. And, you know, of course, the right wing ones are more hypocritical, too. But it's not like the left wing justices adhere to strict judicial philosophies, as has been written about, you know, for centuries at this point. You know, I mean, is that part of the dynamic of why their, I guess, blatant politicization isn't called out more?
I mean, I think there's a lot of structural reasons why, like, it's been hard for people to notice how partisan the courts are. I mean, one is, there's just always going to be a temptation. I mean, if you give someone immense power and a lifetime appointment, like, I don't care who you are, you're always going to be tempted to abuse your power. Like, that is just an inherently dangerous type of authority to give someone. But I think, like, another structural problem is that, like, there's a mythology around the courts where, like, judges will tell you that, like, no, we're following these doctrines. We're not, you know, and they can dress their opinions up in very complicated language that, you know, I spent 3 years in law school to learn how to speak that language. And then most of the people who know how to speak that language have a vested interest in the system. Because, you know, if you're most lawyers, most people who are experts on the courts are lawyers, and a lawyer's job is to get people to pay them a lot of money by, like, convincing the person that they want to pay them a lot of money that they speak the secret code that the judges are using in order to make these decisions happen. And if you're a lawyer, you don't want the message you don't want to get out there. And I'll be honest, most cases aren't political. So like most cases really are decided under legal principles. But under these incredibly politicized cases, you know, voting rights, Obamacare, religion, all of these really politicized cases, it really just is politics all the way down. And most of the experts, most of the people who have the ability to speak the language and translate what they're doing are lawyers who have a vested interest in preserving the system because the system is where they make their money. I mean, I guess I speak the way that I do because I'm a lawyer who doesn't practice. And so like, I know the secret code without having any kind of like personal financial interest in maintaining the legitimacy of the system. But I mean, believe me, like, I mean, every time I tweet something critical of like the Supreme Court as an institution or suggesting that maybe these guys are engaged in rank partisanship, it is inevitable that someone who is a partner at a law firm, often people that I like personally, is going to come back at me and say, no, that's a bad. And, you know, I mean, if I was making $600,000 a year, convincing my clients that like the courts are totally legitimate and operate under legal principles and that I have the power to translate those legal principles to get like, yeah, I would want to preserve that system too.
And I'll say just from my own personal experience in having similar arguments with my father, that it's not even as in semi-retirement and you're part of a clergy in their mind. And so, you know, it's basically saying like, yeah, this whole God concept, I'm a little, shaky on, and they don't want to hear that. But speaking, since we're using that metaphor, let's talk about, briefly, religion. There is a concerted attempt by the court, and it's been building for years, in terms of particularly under the auspices of the Religious Freedom Act, but just the broad concept of essentially saying, here's one more thing that you don't have to abide by in terms of our civil society because you are religious. Essentially, how is that happening?
Yeah, I mean, like one thing about writing a book is that like the Supreme Court has moved so fast on religion that many of the worst case scenarios that I predicted in the book have now become real after the book was published. So, you know, I mean, this starts with the Hobby Lobby decision, which was the first decision to say that you have a religious objection to the law. Not only can you gain an exemption to it, but you can gain an exemption to it even if that exemption hurts someone else. So like, I mean, there's a long line of cases saying that people with religious objections to the law can sometimes be exempted from it. And I think for the most part, those decisions are good. Like, you know, there are laws dealing with Saturday Sabbatarians, you know, people who believe that Saturday is a sacred day that they shouldn't have to work and they wanted a day off work. And yeah, like you should get the day off work. You know, there's a lot of cases involving Muslims and Sikh men who believe that they should grow a beard. And so like basically these cases involve prisoners and cops. There are prisoners who are told that they have to shave so long as they're incarcerated. And there are cases involving cops that like there's a dress code and says they have to shave. And you have Muslim and Sikh men who say like my religious belief says that I should grow a beard. And I think those people should be allowed to grow a beard. Like it doesn't hurt anyone. What is new is that the Supreme Court, and this started with the Hobby Lobby decision, has said that religious objections, or at least certain religious objections, can be used to diminish the rights of others. So Hobby Lobby involved a federal regulation that ensured that workers would get birth control coverage through their employer health plans. You had employers who didn't like birth control. And so their right to exercise their religion trumped the rights of the employees to get birth control. The newest rounds of cases we're seeing right now deal with two issues. One is discrimination. You know, you have a lot of cases involving people who want to discriminate against LGBT people and who claim they have a religious right to do so. And then the really new and really scary line of cases deal with COVID-19 restrictions, where you have states that say, like, you can't have a bunch of people gather together in one place and like infect each other. And these are generally universally applicable rules. You can't gather in a church, you can't gather in a movie theater, you can't gather in like a stadium. You know, they're trying to prevent these kinds of gatherings. And churches and occasionally other houses of worship has sued. And the Supreme Court has been, after Justice Barrett was confirmed, became very, very permissive of these churches that are saying that they want to get exemptions from public health rules. And so in this case, you have a situation where people literally will die if COVID-19 is allowed to spread uncontrollably. You've got states trying to restrict its spread. And the Supreme Court is saying that the rights of religious objectors even trump public health laws whose purpose is to preserve human life. And that's very new. I mean, I don't want to be insensitive to people's religious beliefs. Like, there are lots of cases where people seek exemptions. And I think in most of those cases, people should get them. But when you're trying to take away the rights of another person, or when you're doing something that literally endangers the lives of others, the court has historically said, no, you don't get an exemption in those cases. And that has changed.
Well, what is the limiting principle on that? I mean, so far we've seen things like, okay, if I'm an employer, I don't have to pay for insurance. But I mean, how do you not like, how does that not get into like, you know, I'm a taxpayer and I don't want to pay for, you know, I just don't think that poor people should get health insurance like for free from the government. That's not, that's against my, you know, religious sense of you know,
of
self
being a jerk.
self-sufficiency. I mean, how do we not get to that point?
Yeah, I mean, I worry that there isn't a limiting principle. I mean, the Supreme Court has said that taxes, like you can't claim a religious right not to pay taxes. And so, you know, I mean, the court's moved significantly to the right since it said that. So we'll see if that principle stands. I mean, the other thing that I'm afraid of is that the limiting principle might be, which faith do you belong to? So like, I mean, there are some cases, like, I don't want to suggest that like every Muslim who brings a case loses. I mean, like, there's the cases I talked about involving men who wanted to grow beards, and those plaintiffs typically prevail. But there was Trump's Muslim ban, like, not that long ago, and the Supreme Court upheld that. There was a decision that the Supreme Court backed away from after a huge backlash, including from prominent members of the religious right. But there was a decision a few years ago where a state said that if you are on death row and you're a Christian, you are allowed to have a Christian pastor present during your execution. But if you were Muslim, you were not allowed to have an imam, a member of the Muslim clergy, present. And that was just blatant religious discrimination. Like, you're not allowed to say, if you're this faith, you get this, and if you're this faith, you get less. But the Supreme Court said that was fine. And you know, they've since backed away. There was an enormous backlash, and like, they decided that was a hill that they don't want to die on. But like, the pattern I've seen from this court is that they have a tremendous amount of sympathy when it is a Christian plaintiff seeking some sort of religious accommodation, and very little sympathy to, you know, members of other faiths. And that's, I mean, that's especially troubling. I mean, like, if you're not willing to apply the rules universally to everyone, then we're not even talking about a constitutional regime. I mean, then you're talking about something approaching Christian nationalism.
We're not going to have time for chapter four, which is the right to sue, but I want to have you back on that. That is, a big bailiwick of mine. I go to this tort conference a couple of times a year, and the access to the courts, hugely important. But we are signing them away in arbitration clauses. We're signing them away in the silos of labor and consumer protections and worker protections and, all sorts of things. But I want to be able to ask you this sort of general question. What do you think? How aggressive is John Roberts going to be in pushing these things? Like, I mean, Are you, when you assess where they're at, you know, 4 months, 5 months, I guess 6 months into a 6-3 dynamic, without a lot of, you know, reason to believe that that's going to change, right? I was going to ask you, do you think Breyer should retire yesterday or 6 months ago or somewhere? But I get the sense I know the answer. But how fast do you think Roberts is going to go? Just as a purely as a court observer and with a sense of like maybe a vague insight into what Roberts' agenda is. How fast are they going to go in imposing this type of, you know, in many instances, radical agenda?
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is that it's not up to Roberts anymore. I mean, it's Kavanaugh and Barrett are now emerging as the median justices on the court, and both of them are well to Roberts' right. So, like, you know, everything depends right now on whether we can convince Brett Kavanaugh or Amy Coney Barrett to, like, hold their fire. And I mean, the question of how fast they're going to go, I'm not sure. Like, I was surprised that they seemed to be holding their fire on everything but religion after Biden took office. Like, there's a big abortion case that they were asked to hear months ago, and they've just been sitting on it. Like, they haven't turned it away, but they haven't agreed to hear it either. And that's surprised me. I mean, I was expecting, especially given Justice Barrett's passion for, you know, abolishing Roe v. Wade, that like that was something they would do right away. There was a guns case that they sat on for a little while, and then they just agreed to hear a big guns case. So like they seem to be accelerating their pace somewhat. I think that there's going to be a lot of bad election law cases that come down because we're entering a redistricting cycle. And so there will inevitably be lawsuits about, I mean, some of the justices think that in states where you have a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor, the governor may not be allowed to veto a bill. And like those lawsuits are going to be brought, the court's going to have to resolve them. There's a big Voting Rights Act case in front of the Supreme Court now. I was worried that they were going to get rid of the Voting Rights Act potentially in its entirety within that case. Based on the oral argument, I think they're likely to be more incremental. So like the court isn't moving as fast as it could move, but it's not exactly holding its fire either. And there's just a lot of issues like all these redistricting cases where like, you know, we have to have an election in 2022. People have to know what the maps are. And so they can't avoid those cases.
Right. Well, Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent at Vox, author of The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. Thank you so much for your time today. We will put a link to your book at majority.fm. Hope to talk to you again soon about the chapters we left on the table.
All right. Thanks so much, Sam.
Thank you.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back. Finish this up. We are back. Just wrapping things up here.
We are back, but not for long.
Not for long. I can't recommend reading Ian Millhiser's book enough, or going back and just listening to some of the interviews that we've done. The things like the non-delegation clause and their doctrine and the Chevron doctrine, and these issues are going to be really prominent in your daily lives, and you will never hear about them really in any of your news outlets because it's just too boring for people. And that's why I like to talk about it so much. We'll be back tomorrow, Friday, and that's exciting.
Yeah.
Right. See you then. All right. We're still here. It is Thursday, folks. You know what that means. We're heading into the fun half. Just a little teaser for tomorrow. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to have a... I don't know, we're breaking format. Usually the second guest we have on a Friday. Yeah, I guess we're breaking format. The second guest on a Friday, is usually like somebody who's, you know, funny or amusing or mildly amusing.
Right.
And maybe talking about, you know, TV or film or something like that. All of that type of stuff. And... we are, we just got this as the first IM. On Sunday, the trial of Stephen Donziger will start. Please look into it. His heroic story of legal activism is nothing short of unbelievable. The entire USA legal system, both public and private, are trying to crush him in retaliation when he successfully sued the oil mega corporation Chevron for nearly $10 billion on behalf of the people of Ecuador. And that is from the Robin Commons. Well, Robin Commons, it's your lucky day, because as I, you were the first IMer of the day. And tomorrow on the program at, for the second guest, instead of someone to tell about film, we're going to be talking to Stephen Donziger, who is that attorney. He is under house arrest. His trial is...
I didn't realize we finally got him.
We've
been trying to have him on for a little while, right?
Yeah. The trial starts in a couple of days. We're going to have him on before the trial starts. And so more than worthwhile to tune in for tomorrow. I mean, yes. You should tune in every day.
Yeah, please.
But that's
going to be really great. And, you know, we should just be telling people to watch our Peacock interviews more. Because there's so much good stuff there.
There's so much good stuff there. It is not... Someone said the other day that it was behind a... what do you call it?
A paywall.
Yeah, paywall. It's not.
You have to sign up, but then, you know, you can watch them for free.
You sign up for
ads,
free.
But yeah.
You sign up for free. And then there's like a download function to it.
But if you have a Roku, get Peacock. You just got to create an account, and then you can watch all of our
Apple
stuff.
TV, or you can do it on your phone, too.
Yeah,
you just get the Peacock app.
Yeah, yeah.
And then,
they have the John Wick movies, too. That's why I signed up.
And there you go. But it's free. It's free. You got to go through, you know, watch ads, but it's free. And then, you know, people download those things, and then they post them on YouTube. And I don't know how we would stop them from doing it. I hope that doesn't happen. Anyways, folks, so tune in tomorrow. And just remember, your support makes this show possible. When you become a member of the Majority Report, you get the free show, you get free commercials, even though you can go back and look at the podcast description or the YouTube description and see, you know, what are the ad deals that we have? Because, you know, 10% off this, 10% off that, 20% off this, 20% off that, that type of thing. And it's your support that makes the show possible. A lot of people, frankly, still, we have, you know, over 400,000 people getting on unemployment this week. Still some people hurting. If you are one of those people who are not hurting and you enjoy this show, your support is more than welcome and helpful. Join themajorityreport.com. Check it out. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. Also, majoritydiscord.com. You can go and see what old Matt's dad is saying or what even old Matt is saying and check it out. majoritydiscord.com. And of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. Get 10% off. Joining, are we going to have, is Brandon on today?
No.
No, we can't do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's out sick.
Okay. On the fun half today, it's going to be the Matts and the Emmas and the Brendans holding down the fort. Old Matt, what's happening on Doomed?
I think the sign-ups to the Discord just went through the roof. There's a lot of people clamoring.
I bet. I don't have any doubt about that. Poggers. It's gone poggers.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't even know what that one means. But anyway, yeah. Oh, Mr. Zoomer over here, Sam Cedar.
Right, though. That's the one thing I know.
Anyway.
They don't care.
Tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern time at youtube.com/Matt Binder, we'll be having a show on another Facebook episode, unplanned, but who knew Facebook was going to have their oversight board was going to decide to rule on their big Trump decision. So tonight we'll be talking about that and how it is actually what the oversight board ruled is actually the worst case scenario for Mark Zuckerberg and completely blows up the whole reason he set up the oversight board in the first place.
Oh, so,
I know the answer to that. He's pissed off everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. So youtube.com/Matt Binder, 9 p.m. Eastern time. Subscribe now and catch it tonight, or doomthecast.com for the podcast version of the show, which goes up shortly after.
And new Matt, what is happening on the Matt Lekian universe of media?
Yeah, Luke Savage, staff writer at Jacobin, is going to be joining David Griscom and I tonight, 8 Eastern, at Left Reckoning's YouTube channel to talk about an easy target, Bill Gates, and a harder target nowadays, Big Pharma. So we're going to be talking about that with Luke tonight. And we'll also be talking about big city liberals, moderate liberals, and why they're averse to taxation and want to recall Chesa Boudin and do all sorts of horrible stuff. The enemy is closer now. For instance, like the stab in the back in Austin of the homeless population. So we're going to get into that politics a little bit too tonight. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel, folks, now.
All right, folks. You will see these guys in the fun half. I will be back tomorrow. Until then, adieu.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiot.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
but Sam, I got to get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.